poet Wallace Stevens famously spent his career working as an insurance executive. Arthur Conan Doyle was a surgeon. Anthony Trollope was a postal clerk. There is a long and storied history of authors who spent much of their lives doing something else besides being authors, especially before the proliferation of professional creative writing programs. Well, on this episode, you're going to hear from two doctors and a lawyer, all who led incredibly successful second lives on the printed page. Maybe there's still hope for us all. The reinvention of Khaled Hosseini, Scott Turow, and Charles Krauthammer on this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
As you know, if you've been listening to What It Takes, we usually feature an interview from the Academy of Achievement archive and go deep into the story of one fascinating life. But every so often, we like to show off the speeches that are part of the Academy's archive. These are talks given by some of the world's most inspiring people, talks that have been the centerpiece of the Academy of Achievement summits since they began in 1961. So today, we start with Khaled Hosseini. He told the story in 2008 of his unlikely path from Afghanistan to America, from doctor to novelist, before a room full of young scholars. It was 5 years after he'd published his first book, The Kite Runner, an international sensation that spent 101 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list.
Oh, thank you very much. I've been answering questions for the last 5 years since my novel came out, on tour and at speaking engagements, and I've heard just about every question that I imagined I would hear. Some, you know, ordinary questions that I expected to hear, others not so, including one where somebody asked me whether I would prefer to be an astronaut or a janitor, to which I said astronaut because I've already done the janitor thing. So. You know, two of the most common questions I get asked are, one is, why did you choose to write? And I don't have a good answer for that because I've yet to meet a writer who chose to write. I think for most writers, the act of writing comes as a compulsion, which is very, very difficult to resist. And I personally have had no control over my urge to write than I do over my bone marrow to produce platelets and red cells. And the second question is, did you want to be a writer when you were a kid? When I was a kid, actually, what I wanted to be was Clint Eastwood. You know, I'd seen the guy wearing that cool poncho and that cigar and that hat, and that's what I wanted to be. In fact, I still want to be Clint. So I went to my dad and I said, this is what I want to do with my life. I want to be just like Clint Eastwood. So can you please take me to Iran so I can meet this amazing Iranian actor, Clint Eastwood? And to which my father sat me down and said, son, Clint may be speaking Farsi on the screen, but there's this thing called voice dubbing, so I hate to break it to you. So then I moved on, and I told my parents over time that I wanted to be an astronaut, and then I wanted to be a karate expert guy. But interestingly, I never told them what I eventually became, which was a doctor and a writer, probably so as not to raise false hopes in the former and not to cause undue sleeplessness in the latter. This was, you know, in the 1970s, a time of peace and anonymity in Afghanistan, where frankly, a lot of people actually had a hard time, certainly nobody in this group, but a lot of people had a hard time placing Afghanistan on a map, and I'll never forget the first time in Europe when somebody asked me where I was from, and I told them, and they gave me this blank look, and they had no idea where it was. And that time, my life was quite different from the life of a subsequent generation of Afghan children who have been born amid conflict. Growing up in Kabul in the 70s, I never heard a gunshot. Although there were tanks at the military barracks, they never moved and they just collected dust. You know, in those days, kids could not, as they can do now, assemble a Kalashnikov by the time you get to 10 Mississippi. And our textbooks did not include things like, and I was in Kabul and I saw these math textbooks that people had used in the early 90s and in the 80s, and the questions went something like, you know, if you have 20 Mujahid and you have 16 grenades, how many grenades per Mujahid do you get? It was a very different time, and I feel very lucky to have experienced Afghanistan at that time. So it's very, very lucky. I became even luckier when my father, who worked for the foreign ministry, came home one day and told us that he'd been assigned a post in Paris, that we were going to move to Paris for a while. That was lucky in and of itself. It turned out to be extremely lucky because when we went to Paris, and it was supposed to be a four-year assignment, we were going to be there from 1976 to 1980, and then we were going to come back. So we left everything behind, all of our belongings, just packed some clothes, and the family moved to Paris. But, of course, while we were in France, Afghanistan unraveled. First with a very vicious and bloody coup in April of 1978 that saw the murder of the Afghan president, Dawood Khan, at the royal palace, the presidential palace, and some 20 members of his family. It was a very difficult time for my family because you feel helpless being abroad and getting news of what's going on back home and hearing stories of friends and family members who've been imprisoned, who've been killed, or in some ways infinitely worse, have gone missing and nobody knows their fate. So the prospects of returning home suddenly looked grim. They all but evaporated, I guess, in December of 1979 when I was at home with my folks watching television and we had the news break that the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan. And I remember seeing the pictures of those tanks rolling in and those Soviet soldiers moving in. And I saw my parents exchange a look. And at that moment, I knew that we weren't going to return home. And in fact, to this day, none of the then 9 people in my family have gone back to Afghanistan, with the exception of myself. So unbeknownst to us, my dad went about getting political asylum for the family. And it was a time of kind of, felt a little bit like living in a John le Carré novel, where my dad would, when we would go anywhere, he would make us stop, and then he would go to the car, turn it on, and then he would say, okay, you guys can come now. But he applied for asylum, and we packed our bags and moved to the U.S. In the fall of 1980 in San Jose, where there was already kind of the beginning and the seed of a burgeoning Afghan community in those early years. When we arrived to the U.S., my father said we have to do 2 things. First is that we have to get a proper American family car. So he went about looking for one, and one day he drove home in a 1970 Dodge Charger, which was his notion of a proper American family car. The Dodge Charger, for those of you who don't know, is the mother of all hot rods. It's every teenage boy's wet dream. So he drove home in this thing, and I'll never forget when he packed all 9 of us in the Charger, and as we were going through the neighborhood, and the windows were rattling, and everybody in the garage stopped what they were doing, and they watched this family of Afghan refugees drive down the road. And then he took us to the Capitol Expressway drive-ins, and we watched Superman 2. The second thing he said we have to do is hang a picture of Ronald Reagan in our home, because this we got to the States just before the election of my father's great hero, President Reagan. And the reason for that was because Mr. Reagan had gone on television and called the Soviets the evil empire, and he said he would do anything it would take to defeat the Soviet empire. And the West was putting out a call to Muslim brothers around the world to come and fight in Afghanistan. And so my father put a picture of Ronald Reagan in his home, and I think Mr. Reagan made Republicans out of a lot of Afghans with those words. And certainly my father has been a devout Republican since those days. Ironically, we were living in a very blue-collar neighborhood and we're all welfare as my father was driving around the Dodge Charger with the Reagan-Bush sticker on it. My parents set about getting jobs, and my dad became he tried to sell insurance, and he worked on an assembly line, and then eventually he became a driving instructor, and he had this van where he would was fit with all these gadgets and lifts and everything. It was for the physically challenged, and so he would teach them how to drive up and down the streets of San Francisco. My mom became was a waitress at Denny's for a while. She had been the vice principal of a very large high school for girls in Kabul, but she waited tables at Denny's for a while, and we would go there at 11 o'clock at night, sit in her sections and leave these big tips for her. And eventually, she went to beauty school and learned how to cut hair and eventually became a beautician. She worked in a small hole-in-the-wall salon in East San Jose for a better part of 20 years until she retired a couple of years ago. And in that time, while they were doing this, their message to us was that, okay, now we're doing this stuff and this is fine, but you have to make something yourself. And you have to go to school, you have to get an education, and you have to make us proud. And I was the firstborn. I'm a firstborn son, and I must have felt a weight of responsibility and expectation of what the sacrifice that my parents were doing, and so I decided to go to medical school. The thought of going becoming a writer never crossed my mind. It seemed outlandish that I would become a writer, largely because the only words in English that I knew were hello, goodbye, thank you, and for some obscure reason, the word gluttony. At any rate, I gave medicine in my 20s. I became a physician, and eventually, in the spring of 1999, saw a television report about the Taliban banning the sport of kite flying. That led to a short story, which I wrote pretty much on the spot, which I thought was going to be about kites. It ended up being about betrayal and guilt and friendship and Afghanistan. And eventually, that story was discovered by my wife in the spring of in early 2001, and I went back to it and decided there was a novel in it, and I would use it to write my first novel, which of course became The Kite Runner. During the writing of the novel, September 11th happened. I abandoned the novel for about 3 months and had pretty much decided that I was done with it until my wife talked some sense into me and said, your book in some way will help change people's perspectives about Afghanistan, so you should write it. And I did, and I'm really glad that I listened to her. I'm running out of time. I feel compelled to give you three pieces of advice. I'm not good at giving advice, but first I'll echo George Lucas from yesterday. Find joy in your life and do what you and only you want to do. The best and the brightest of you will end up doing something that somebody else wants you to do. I guarantee you, don't do it. Secondly, make sure you get very lucky. And number three, be grateful. Be very grateful for what you have. My dream is that one day I will come here and that there will be another Afghan writer at this podium. There are so many writers in Afghanistan who are undoubtedly far more eloquent and visionary than I am, but their moment and their opportunity has been stolen by them through war and poverty and suffering of various sorts. So my dream is that one day I will come and I will see one of them at this podium speak. And if it happens to be a woman, the most beleaguered member of that beleaguered nation, that would make me that much more proud. Thank you very much.
Khaled Hosseini has a new novel out due in September of 2018. It's about a Syrian refugee and is called Sea Prayer. There's another doctor turned writer in the house today, but we're going to go first to one of the most famous lawyers in America. Famous not so much for his talents before a judge, though he had those in good supply too. But no, we're talking here about his ability to create suspense and intrigue with a pen. Scott Turow is the author of Presumed Innocent, The Burden of Proof, Personal Injuries, and many other best-selling novels, 5 of which have been turned into movies. Like Khaled Hosseini, Scott Turow paid tribute to the gods of good old-fashioned luck during his talk at an Academy of Achievement summit. That was in Chicago back in 1990.
My dream as a young person, from the time I was probably 10 or 11 years old, was to be a writer, a novelist. And I began pursuit of that dream by writing novels when I was in college. And I was fortunate enough to win a writing fellowship at Stanford, and after that to serve for 3 years on the faculty there as a lecturer in the English department. And during those years, I discovered that things were not going very well for me as a writer. I wrote a novel there. I made a very serious attempt at writing a good novel, but there were at least 23 publishers in New York who did not share my opinion of that book. It was called The Way Things Are, and indeed it taught me the way things are. And for that reason, but much more so because in the process of writing that novel, which was about a rent strike, I had uncovered a totally surprising to me interest in the law, I made the decision to go to law school. As I say, this was a bit of a shock to me. My father is a doctor, and he was to some extent a prophet in his own time, which is to say that he hated lawyers long before it was fashionable for doctors to do so. But having uncovered this interest in the law, I decided that I would pursue it, and it was at that point that the first true stroke of luck in my literary career took place. I wrote to the poor, unfortunate literary agent in New York who had been trundling around this novel, The Way Things Are, to different publishers and getting it back. And as really as a sop to her to explain this decision that I had made, I told her that I thought it would be a good idea if someone wrote a book about the experience of being a law student, a nonfiction book. Now, of course, I did not have in mind myself as the author of this book. As I mentioned, my dream was to be a novelist, a writer of fiction. But it was somewhat symptomatic of the difficulties in my relationship with my agent, and there were some problems, that she did not understand that I was not talking about myself. And so it was that I came back to my apartment one day. I was living in San Francisco then and found a letter that was very different than the letters I was usually getting from my agent. Usually it was a two-sheet piece of correspondence I got from her, a cover letter that said, here's another one, and then a rejection slip underneath it. But this time, what there was a contract to write a nonfiction book about my first year experience as a law student. And as I say, I was a novelist, a writer of fiction, but I'd also seen about 20 rejection slips at that point. And so, of course, I ran into the apartment, signed the contract, and then went off to Harvard Law School to make new friends and to write about them. I did write the book, 1L. As far as I can tell, that contract to write it was very much the product of a somewhat, shall we say, watery Friday afternoon conversation between the agent and the editor who had bought it. And when I finished 1L, the editor even called me up and apparently had no recollection of this wine-soaked conversation, because he said to me, gee, I've read this book, and I just have one thing to ask you about it. And I said, didn't I follow your directions? He said, oh, yeah, you followed my directions just fine. I just want you to remind me of one thing. Why did I want to buy this book? But at any rate, 1L came out in 1977. It had reasonably good success. But at that point, my involvement with the law was such that I had absolutely no thought of turning away from that career. By the same token, I became an assistant United States attorney in Chicago. But I also wanted to go back to my first ambition, to be a novelist. And so every morning on the commuter train on the way into the city, the train that I still ride, I wrote by longhand on certain notebooks. And the book I began is now known as Presumed Innocent. And after about 2 years of writing longhand, I got to a certain point in the plot where Not only did I not know who had killed Carolyn Paul Hemus and presumed innocent, but I did not understand any of the many multiplying subplots. I decided it would be a good time to take some time off. And for those of you who have not read Presumed Innocent, it is known principally as a courtroom novel. But of course, I had not gotten that far at that point. And again, at this point, the second stroke of luck comes into play, namely my agent, yet again, who called me up and said, what are you doing? And I told her I was indeed writing and that I'd very excited about this novel. It's about a prosecutor who's investigating the murder of his mistress. And she interrupted me at that point. She knew what I was doing for a living. And she said, well, there's a trial in there, isn't there? And of course, I was always too abashed by my agent to say no. So I said yes. And that's where the 190-page trial in Presumed Innocent comes from. The last stroke of luck came a few years after that, when I'd gone back to writing Presumed Innocent on a somewhat episodic basis and was involved in the trial of one of the cases that it was known locally as a Greylord case. Greylord was a project embarked upon by the United States Attorney's Office here in which a number of judges and lawyers were accused of various crimes related to corruption in the state court system here. And I tried one of those cases involving a judge who had the habit of calling various parties and lawyers and court appointees into his chambers and usually on the eve of trial explaining to them that he was in dire financial straits and that he would like to borrow, say, $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000, money which generally went unreturned. And this case caught the fancy of the Chicago media. It became one of the most prominent, if not the most prominent, of the Greylord trials. And as that happened and the attention and the tension in the case itself increased, I found myself sleepless more and more often. And as happens when I am sleepless, my wife Annette was sleepless. And so it was that one morning, very early in the morning, she propped herself up on one elbow and spoke to me the words that I think are probably familiar to the spouses of lawyers everywhere, namely, I want you to quit that goddamn job. What Annette had in mind was that that I should leave the U.S. Attorney's Office as soon as that jury went out and finish Presumed Innocent. And I did that. And I am here today because I had the good luck to marry a woman who in many ways was more courageous than I am and who inspired me, in spite of the fact that we had two young children, to basically give up my job for a while and finish this book and sort of pursue what had always seemed to me to be my great dream. From all of this, I take certain lessons that I do mean to sincerely impart, no matter how mawkish it may sound. I don't think you will hear from anybody this weekend who has not been blessed by extraordinary great luck. I looked at Michael Jordan up here earlier, who is clearly in his calling as superior as probably any human being I know of, and thought to myself, of course, but he credits the good fortune of the parents that he had, and I'm sure that there is a great deal in what he is saying. You young persons who are here, nothing will erase your talent. I promise you that. But no one can guarantee you what will come of it. With the kind of luck that I have enjoyed, and frankly, I think any person who comes to any kind of prominence enjoys, it's likely that many of you will come and stand in places like this. But that is not the true measure of achievement. When Presumed Innocent was sold to the publishers first, a reporter showed up from the New York Times and sort of looked around my house and noticed that my wife and I had not yet moved, in spite of the fact that I'd made more money in a month than I had in the 8 years that I'd worked for the United States government. And he asked, why hadn't we, you know, bought our chateau on Lake Michigan? And my wife told him, well, we felt like we were successes already. And that is true. And I offer that to you, that to find what is precious to you in work, in your family, and to work hard at doing it still seems to me to be the great measure of success and self-fulfillment. You will have to depend on good fortune and pure serendipity to make the great achievements. But a life in which you are fortunate enough to determine what is important to you and to pursue it with energy and with a sense of commitment is to me the mark of real achievement. So I thank you very much, and I offer you my nickel's worth of advice, and thank you for your attention.
Scott Turow. We end today's episode with the very brief remarks of Charles Krauthammer, who died just 2 months ago as this podcast episode posts. Mr. Krauthammer was a very different kind of writer than Scott Turow or Khaled Husseini. He was a conservative political columnist whose provocative, erudite writings appeared in the Washington Post every Friday for 30-plus years. He won a Pulitzer Prize for them. He also wrote for Time magazine and The New Republic, and he was a leading thinker of the neocon movement. But like the previous two speakers, Charles Krauthammer had an established life in another career first, as a doctor of psychiatry. When he was honored by the Academy of Achievement in 1999, he didn't talk politics at all. Instead, he used the occasion to embolden the young scholars gathered there to, well, he says it quite eloquently himself, so we'll give him the final word.
As you heard, the achievements for which I'm being recognized, indeed my entire career as a writer and editor and columnist, is a second career. I never wrote a word, I never published a word before I was 30. And the reason I bring this up is because I want to speak to the students about choice, about choosing a life. When you are at the stage you are at right now, all of life is open to you. But soon you are going to suffer the agony of excellence. With so many talents and so much excellence, at one point in your life, soon you're going to have to choose. And every choice means an exclusion. Every time you open a door, you're closing a door. If you decide to be a nuclear scientist, you think you won't ever be able to be a Shakespearean scholar. Well, I'm here to tell you that that's false. I started my life out as a doctor. I spent 7 years as a doctor and a psychiatrist. And then one day at the end of those 7 years, I realized that this was not what I was born to do and to be. So I said goodbye to my last patient. I turned in my beeper, and I quit. In fact, sometimes I try to decide what exactly I am, whether I'm a ex-psychiatrist, a retired physician, a one-time doctor. I'm actually a psychiatrist in remission. And I've been doing extremely well for the last 20 years. No relapses. At the same time, my wife, who was a lawyer, decided that she didn't love the law and she quit as well, and we left our home and we came to Washington to seek our fortune. She became an artist and a sculptor, and I became a writer and a columnist. And things have turned out rather well. The moral of the story is, don't be afraid to choose, and don't be afraid to start all over if you have to. The T.E. Lawrence once said, at least in the version of his life by David Lean, nothing is written. And by that he meant, life is open, everything is choice, nothing is inevitable. So the message I have to you young people is, don't be afraid to choose. Choose what you love, and if you don't love what you've chosen, choose again. Thank you very much.
Wise advice for young people of any age. That's Charles Krauthammer. He was preceded by Scott Turow and Khaled Husseini. Just a quick note, this episode marks our third anniversary. So if you want to celebrate with us, please do. Go back through the catalog and listen to one of your favorites again. Or find one you missed and give it a whirl. While you're there, leave us your comments. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, really any platform for great podcasts. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. Thanks for listening. What It Takes is made possible with funding from the Katherine B. Reynolds Foundation.